apartheid struggle through song. Miriam Makeba addressed the United Nations and in 1966 won a Grammy Award with her mentor, Harry Belafonte, for their joint album, An Evening with Belafonte and Makeba. After 30 years in exile, she returned home to settle in South Africa in the 1990s, once Nelson Mandela was released from jail. Ofebia Kwistarkton, NPR News, Harare.
An 8-year-old Arizona boy is scheduled to appear in juvenile court today to face 2 counts of premeditated murder. Police say the third grader confessed to the shooting deaths of his father and a man who worked with him and rented a room in the family home. Authorities say they still do not know what prompted the killings, but they're looking into whether the boy had been abused. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Monarchy, Royal Family at Work, a year-long look inside the modern British monarchy, Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Planned Parenthood of Illinois, whose mission is to provide quality, affordable sexual health care. Planned Parenthood is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deduction at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning. This is hour number 2 of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry. He's at the controls this morning. Though it may seem strange to us today, there was a time in America when local courts could be called on to determine a person's race. And the stakes in these trials could be very high. They could involve the person's very freedom, also their property and civil rights. This morning we'll be talking with historian Ariella Gross about her book, What Blood Won't Tell. The subtitle is A History of Race on Trial in America, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. And it explores the history of race by looking up the stories of racial identity trials, and among other things, what the author argues is, despite our belief that race is something that is very self-evident, she says that Americans have never really reached a consensus about what race means or how to discover it. Our guest, Ariella Gross, is professor of law and history at the University of Southern California. She's joining us this morning by phone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just are brief so that we could get in as many as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But, of course, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. The number, if you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, you're interested in joining the conversation, you know, just pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Gross, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Very well.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think the place that I would ask you to start, is, as you do indeed start in the book, and that is to tell us the story of Alexina Morrison.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Alexina Morrison was a slave in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, and she ran away from her master and ran to the local jail, threw herself on the mercy of her jailer, and told him the story that she'd been kidnapped into slavery but was actually white. And he believed her. He took her home to live with his family, introduced her into white society, and she won over the white citizens of the town to such an extent that when her master came to file an answer to her lawsuit for freedom, he said that he was surrounded by a lawless mob of whites and he was afraid that he was going to be lynched. So she did this kind of remarkable thing in persuading her white neighbors to support her suit for freedom. Her lawsuit went through 3 trials, and what was striking to me about the case is that her master had all the documents to show that she'd been a slave, her mother had been a slave, documenting her ancestry. But that wasn't really persuasive to the witnesses or to the jurors. And they were, what most of the testimony was about and what they seemed to be persuaded by was other neighbors coming in and talking about how she behaved at balls, who she associated with, and that she kind of performed white womanhood. And, of course, she also had some doctors who came in to talk about, who said, you know, we can read the hidden signs of race that you can't read. That seemed much more important than ancestry. So while we talk about rules of drops of blood or parenthood, in fact, what was more important in determining race were science, the pseudo-racial science on the one hand, and performance. Mm-hmm. On the other.
That, to me, it's just really fascinating because I think that here, at least now, we can sort of separate these two things. But I guess I'm thinking about the fact that for a lot of people, the race kind of was what they decided that it was going to be, and that here what was really important in a case like this for someone like Alexina Morrison, who was saying, no, actually, I'm white and I was kidnapped and held in slavery and I deserve to be free. The question was, for the people that were making this decision, the question was, did this person behave, whatever that meant, did they behave like a white person, but also did other white people accept them as white? And that those two things carried as much weight as maybe even more in some people's minds as the other sorts of things, that is, what a person maybe looked like or what, you know, what somebody else might have said. That, to me, that's really very, very interesting.
It is. You know, I called the book What Blood Won't Tell because it's the history of this idea, this ideology of race that depends both on the notion that race is something in your blood, some fact of nature, which, you know, as we know, scientists have proven isn't true, but is still a remarkably persistent idea. But on the other hand, the notion that blood would tell, that it would race would reveal itself through people's outward actions. In the 20th century, we've sort of divided notions of race and culture as something separate. But for a lot of our history, and I think continuing in our common sense ideas of race, those are very linked, that, you know, inevitably, if someone is of a certain identity, it will make itself known in outward signs.
And just one other point at this point to make the way that I've been talking about this, and perhaps people would get the idea that this kind of thing, a racial identity trial, was something that would have happened long time ago, or at least certainly the kind of thing that maybe would have happened before the Civil War or during Reconstruction. In fact, the last one of these trials took place, do I remember this right, it was in the 60s?
The book, in fact, does go through the middle of the 20th century, and of course these do change form. My focus turns to other forums besides local courtrooms. I look at what, for example, the administrative commissions who went to enroll Indians in Indian territory, what they were doing when they did quite similar kinds of adjudications of people's identity in order to decide what Indian role they should go on. But, for example, trials that were based on a marriage across the color line, those weren't banned until 1967. I think that's probably where the date, right? Yeah. We were still in this country banning interracial marriage in many states of the country until 1967. So you would see cases both where the state brought a criminal prosecution against a couple or one member of a couple, also cases where, for example, a husband would seek to end his marriage, and he would say, I don't just want a divorce, I want the marriage annulled because, in fact, it violated the ban on interracial marriage.
So that, I guess the point, though, that does uphold the point that we were still in the atmosphere of the courtroom, in the area of the courts, people were still litigating these issues and they were still arguing about them in front of judges into the 20th century.
Yeah. Yes, and other kinds of cases, for example, schools, segregated schools, meant that there would be trials about the rights of certain children to attend white schools, or until 1952, we said that the only people who could, immigrants who could naturalize to citizenship in the United States were free white persons. So when entire groups of people from China, India, Japan came to the United States, then courts dealt with the question, are they white?
Just very quickly, Ed, let me introduce again our guest, Ariella Gross. She is a professor of law and history at the University of Southern California, author of the book What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America, published by the Harvard University Press. Well, just for a moment to go back to Alexina Morrison, as you mentioned, there were three trials held. We don't know ultimately what happened to Alexina Morrison, but there were other people, other similar kinds of trials, indeed, people were found that process, were judged by the court to be white, were given their freedom. This would have been before emancipation. How common were trials like that, where it was someone who was saying, "No, I have been unjustly held. I am white, and I am appealing to the court to be granted my freedom."
It kind of depends which perspective you look at. If you compare to the millions enslaved in the South, there are a small number of trials. There were dozens that made it to the high courts of Southern states in those decades. But they actually became prominent public events. The newspapers reported on them. They got picked up by both sides of the battle over slavery between North and South. Fugitive slaves who escaped to the North wrote about them in their narrative, so they're picked up by abolitionists as evidence. Look at this. A woman like Alexina, blue-eyed and flaxen-haired, she could be enslaved. No one is safe. That was their, you know, message. Anyone could be enslaved. This is a terrible system. But Southerners would point to the fact that, as you say, some people did win their freedom to say, look how law-abiding we are. We have this system, but when we're proven wrong, when we make a mistake, we go through legal channels and set someone free. So they very much became a focal point for the battle over slavery as well.
Mm-hmm. And just also, this was something that perhaps in different ways, the focus was different after emancipation. But here, so you would have to say that maybe the big issue before would truly have been freedom, the issue of Britain's freedom. But that they were also, once you got past that, then there was still a lot of very important issues at stake where people were fighting for, as you say, perhaps they might be fighting for their right to marry the person of their choice. That might be about access to education. It might be about citizenship. It might be about rights of inheritance. So there were still a lot of very important things.
Absolutely.
That people were fighting for here.
Absolutely. And these cases as well, some of them continue to garner a lot of public attention. For example, cases about what became known as miscegenation, the interracial sex and marriage cases, also became quite notorious. Some of them got a lot of public newspaper attention, media attention in places not just in the South, but places like New York City. One of the big cases, Warner versus Warner, was in Illinois. Often they involved prominent people and got a lot of public attention, whereas some of this stuff really happens under the radar. For example, I have my chapters on what's going on in Indian territory, very, very important for the Indian nations themselves, who in fact are still, many of them, fighting over this to this day. The Seminole Nation and the Cherokee Nation are now involved in trying to exclude their African-American citizens from citizenship, and that they're in the federal courts today. But that wasn't, now it's getting some public attention, but in the 19th century that was pretty under the radar for, you know, in terms of how well known it was. But it's kind of risen to the public eye today.
This is something interesting that that all along it seems that the way that Native Americans thought about this and the way that people thought about Native Americans, it was really very different from the way people thought about about African Americans, about Black Americans, and who they were and what they were.
Native Americans have occupy this very unusual place in the American legal and political system. From the start, they were thought of as foreign nations, right? They were separate nations. In the Constitution, they are not included as U.S. citizens. There's always a category of Indians not taxed in the Constitution. And that identity as nations allows them to be, some rights of sovereignty and self-determination that certainly isn't given to any other group in American society. But from very early on, their sovereignties, as we know, their sovereignty was under attack, and that meant from very early on, there develops this idea that, you know, maybe Indian is a racial identity. Is it a political or is it a racial identity? And it becomes kind of this hybrid thing. The more it's seen as racial, the more they're just like any other, the more they're like Blacks, the like other minority groups, and can be regulated. And we see that a lot of tension arising in cases where, in fact, Indians mixed with Blacks. So many groups on the Eastern Seaboard absorbed African American members. As to the extent that they do that, they start to be seen by the legal system as not really Indian anymore. Now they're people of color to the extent they mix with Blacks. Then, of course, there were the tribes in the Southeast who adopted, as part of a program of becoming more civilized, they adopt a slavery, African slavery, and when they're removed to what's now Oklahoma, they bring slaves with them. And so they have all the issues that the rest of the society has of how to integrate ex-slaves into their societies.
Something I'd like to have you talk some more about, we talked a little bit earlier about these kinds of trials where the issue was the person's race and that there were two sort of sides being argued, or at least there were two ways of approaching the question. One would be sort of biological and physiological, and the other would be, in a sense, social, in the sense that it had to do with people's behavior and the company that they kept. There certainly would have been a time when there would have been people who would have said, well, the different races have very distinct physical characteristics. They are, can be measured and quantified. So I'm sure that there would be people who would lay claim to being some kind of an expert who would be able to say, well, I can look at a person and I can look at their characteristics and I can tell you whether that person is white or black or Asian or Indian or, mm-hmm. or whatever. And I'm sure that in trials all the way along, we're called to give what I guess would have been considered to be expert testimony as witnesses. How did that enter into it? And you know, to what degree were people persuaded that in fact such a thing could be done, that you could have a scientist or a biologist or anthropologist or whoever, someone call in and come in and say, well, I can look at a person. I will look at this person and I will tell you who and what they are.
Right. Yeah, it's a great question. There is always this, because there's always this underlying anxiety that we don't really know. The people who have their identity litigated are often people about whom their own neighbors disagree about how they look. One person says their hair is straight, and one person says it's curly. And, you know, there are a lot of people whom I end up calling racially ambiguous because they often appear to have survived for decades with quite a bit of disagreement about what category they fall into before it ends up in court. And so there are always people who come forward and say, I'm an expert and I can decide this for you. In the earlier cases, these are basically local doctors, and they say, you know, we know about the follicles of people's hair and the hollows of their feet, and we can tell you, listen to us, we're the experts. The thrust of the cases, though, is always to push it into the community and the common sense of ordinary people. And so what I see as really interesting is that while the language of expertise and that of common sense are in tension, they actually end up kind of merging, because you start to see ordinary citizens getting qualified as experts on the basis of, for example, being a slaveholder. You know, I've been around so quote-unquote Negro people all my life, so I know the hidden signs, and then that person would be qualified as an expert. And then ordinary witnesses learn to say the phrase, I am familiar with the distinctions between the African and the Caucasian races, and then they would be allowed to give testimony on that basis. So you kind of see a merging between this expertise and, in fact, just ordinary people. Now, in the 20th century, that changes somewhat as you get a pretty developed science of physical and then later cultural anthropology. And those people who are now professors in universities who've done, you know, studies measuring people's skulls and then all kinds of other more social scientific studies, they also testify both in citizenship cases and in miscegenation cases, and they also appeal to these ideas of expertise. But often when courts don't like the answers they give, they turn back to a common sense or common man test of, you know, we know it when we see it.
And just, again, to talk about the balancing side of this, where also when courts were trying to make this determination and they also looked at the individual who was at the center of all of this, who no doubt had various kinds of supporters who said, as far as I'm concerned, this person is white, and that it has to do with acceptance and behavior and all sorts of things. Within that context, if the question was, what did it mean to behave like a white person, what exactly did that mean?
Well, one of the things, excuse me, that I found really striking, in the great majority of these cases that involved men, what seemed to really count in terms of men's performance of identity was performing the acts of citizenship. Did a person vote? Did he sit on a jury? Did he muster in the militia? Did he do the things that citizens do? And so this appears to have a kind of circularity. Well, in order to claim the rights of, you know, freedom, citizenship, you have to show you're white. But in order to show you're white, you have to show that you did these things. And so at first, I think it seems circular. But I think if you really understand that idea of blood will tell, it comes to make more sense. That is, the deep equation that people believed in between whiteness and citizenship that made sense of this. It may have been partly, someone else, some other white people have accepted this person, and therefore we might as well too. But I think at a deeper level, it was only a white person could have done these things, could have behaved this way, could have acted like a citizen, because they believed strongly in that deep equation. And that's the thing I think it's still hard for us to break today, that association in our minds between whiteness and citizenship.
We have a caller here to talk with. We are at our midpoint here. I'll very quickly introduce again our guest, Ariella Gross. She is professor of law and history at University of Southern California. Her book, if you're interested in reading more on the subject, the title is What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America, and it's published by the Harvard University Press, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here where we are in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about where some of these trials took place. I'm thinking that some of them would probably have been in the North, in that people fleeing fugitive slave prosecution or whatever. Is this the same time we're talking about then? Or
Yeah, that's a great question. There are cases in the North all the way through the 19th century, even before the Civil War. There are cases, for example, there's a case in Ohio where only whites vote. And so there's a case about, you know, a racial identity trial in Ohio where they decide, well, one white parent is enough to, you know, make you eligible to vote. So these cases do take place in the North even before the Civil War because there were restrictions, some of them on voting, some of them on school attendance in northern states. One thing that was striking to me is that before the Civil War, the cases in the North, there's almost no testimony. There's very little. They're not very hotly contested. There aren't very many of these cases. They don't become kind of cultural, you know, focal points the way the cases in the South do. After the Civil War, at the turn of the century, when the North really kind of commits itself to white supremacy, you know, some historians have written about this as kind of, you know, the bargain of reunion to join together with the South and putting Reconstruction aside and committing to white supremacy. Northern states, more northern states ban interracial marriage and miscegenation, and some of those cases really do become, you know, these kind of massive cultural events. So I think there's a transformation in the North as well.
Well, I was thinking, of course, of the antebellum era when people like, even Abe Lincoln was working as a lawyer here in this region and was taking cases that had to do with sending people back.
Oh, right, fugitive slave cases. So those, most of the lawyers who took those cases, especially in places like Pennsylvania, and there are some in Illinois as well, but a lot of that activity is going on in Pennsylvania, they're mostly arguing technicalities. I mean, they are trying to find ways to keep fugitive slaves from being returned, mostly using the writs of habeas corpus and other writs to try to do it on pretty technical grounds as a strategy for the most part to, you know, take the to kind of wear away at the law, at the fugitive slave laws without a direct confrontation. And so actually you don't see in the northern cases about fugitive slaves the kind of dramatic arguments being made in suits for freedom in the South. I haven't seen any. Most of those claims tend to be much more technically argued.
I have a sort of a meta question, which is, David has been doing a series of what I regard as really revelatory shows about the history of African Americans with Sundown Towns, James Lowen's work, Buried in Bitter Water, I guess it's called, which is the story of the ethnic cleansing of the South,
yes.
Racial cleansing.
Yes,
it's
an amazing book, the Sundown Towns.
Yeah, well, the other one is Buried in Bitter Waters, I guess, which is somebody that Lowen knows. But I find it astonishing. I feel like I'm fairly well informed on some things, and I'm just shocked that there. And then there was another one about how people were sort of impressed in the service, even in the up until World War II era, where people African Americans were busted on trumped up charges and sentenced to work in the Birmingham steel factory. You know, I find it really astonishing, and maybe there will be a breath of new air coming in on some of this. And sort of what I was thinking of asking you was, is your publisher, is anybody, are you working on a grant to make this sort of like a educational package for a variety of levels in school? Because this is the things that are lies that our teachers or the things that our teachers didn't
that aren't getting to the lower level. It's funny.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you want to follow up on that at all?
Oh, I was just saying it's you know, it is true. There is such a time lag from what gets to the you know, down into secondary schools and grade schools in terms of teaching American history. But I think that there's actually, since Jim Lowen wrote the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, which he wrote, I think, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, looking at textbooks, I think there's actually been an enormous improvement in what's available to teachers at the grade levels. And just using the web, I just taught a class in my daughter's eighth grade class on slavery, and I used the incredible resources that PBS has put up based on their, you know, on their wonderful TV series on slavery in the New World, and you know, it was wonderful for eighth grade kids, much more sophisticated level than, you know, what I got when I was in school. So I think there's a lot out there for teachers to use if they're not too bound by, you know, curricula.
We're a bit past our midpoint here, and for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest is Ariella Gross. She's a professor of law and history at University of Southern California, and her book is What Blood Won't Tell. It looks at the history of racial identity trials in America, trials that could be held and have indeed been held, and into the 20th century such things were held, where the issue at stake was what was a person's race? Certainly when there was still slavery, freedom could be the big issue, but also for people, there were other issues as well, things like rights of inheritance, the ability to marry, access to education, citizenship. And it's a very interesting book. You might take a look at it. It's out now. And, of course, questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The book is published by the Harvard University Press. Just for a second, you were talking a little bit earlier about this issue of performing whiteness, and that is part of the judgment that people would make, whether they were deciding, you know, who or what a person was how they behaved. And that in the case of men, you said that part of that had to do with, well, did this person show all the behaviors that you would expect a good citizen to show, that they voted, they participated in politics, they sat on juries when they were called, they did their bit for military service, all those sorts of things. For some of the cases, the very first case that we talked about was the case of a woman, and there were other cases with women. For as far as women were concerned, what was performing whiteness? What involved performing whiteness for a woman?
So for a woman, it had more to do with, you know, certainly in the early cases, the kind of Southern ideal of pure white womanhood, but much more about moral and sexual virtue and honor. So in Alexina's case, when they were trying to impugn her, when her master's witnesses were trying to suggest that she was a woman of color, they suggested that her jailer had fathered her baby and that she had behaved inappropriately at public balls and tried to suggest that she was not a pure white woman, whereas her witnesses and in her case and others would try to show that she was so of such a high virtuous character that she must be white. But interestingly, in many cases where the woman was originally the person at issue, they would then ask, what about her father? Did he vote? Did he sit on a jury? And so on. They would turn it to the next generation and make the case at least as much about a man as about the woman.
Right. Let's talk with another caller here. Someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. If my memory serves me correctly, the gentleman who talked about the sundown towns in the north referred to something that happened in Monticello, which he claimed was in the last few years, and that was that a black family bought a house in Monticello, and it was burnt down. And that is a form of of trial as well, because I assume their children went to the local schools and et cetera. And so I think that this sort of thing is still going on in the North, I'm sorry to say.
Yes, you know, I think you're absolutely right to suggest that there are many practices outside of the courtroom that result in a kind of trial. And, you know, because it's such a sweeping story of where I'm trying to cover two centuries, I do focus on these particular kinds of trials as a window, because otherwise my book would just try to be about everything. But I think you're absolutely right that both that there are other ways that the same kind of thing happens, and that it continued in different forms to the present. One thing your question reminded me of is there were in many places, especially in the Northeast and Southeast, pockets of entire communities of people of a kind of racially ambiguous identity. They get names like the Melungeons, the Redbones, the Croatans, and they, especially up in mountainous areas and Appalachians, they managed to survive well into the 20th century, living kind of with somewhat accepted by white communities, but clearly somewhat separate. And they have this kind of precarious existence where they get to send their kids to the white schools and to vote and so on until they make somebody mad, until there's some incident, some conflict that could be on a very local and personal level, and then someone will kind of appoint himself a racial investigator and go out, and it could take place on a number of fronts. He might, burn a cross on their lawn, but he might also, call a town meeting and say, this person has Negro blood, his kids shouldn't go to the school. And I was so struck by the lengths certain people would go to. They would send investigators to the county the person had come from to collect, hundreds of pages of affidavits and just have a campaign to exclude this family from the community, to expunge them. And that kind of course, that could have an effect on the entire group of families. And so you could see close-up a kind of racial cleansing happening on a very micro level. With these kind of, that might start with a personal vendetta, but turn into, a kind of an expunging from the community.
Yeah. I wanted to thank the caller. And I'm also glad that you gave this particular example, because I think that we've been talking up to this point in a way that would suggest that in most cases in these trials that they're, say individual in that felt it was in their own interest, it was in their self-interest to demonstrate that they were white. It also happened that there were places where someone came along and felt that it was either in their interest or in the community's interest to identify a particular individual and determine that that person was not white.
And I think, in fact, that was much more common. These are relatively few of these cases come up. The only category, really, is the very small number of cases that were suits for freedom. Most of the others are instead about someone challenging another person's identity, or the identity comes up incidentally in a battle over inheritance of property, where someone realizes, hey, my claim is going to be better if I can throw the other one into question by suggesting there was an illegal marriage that took place, or that they have Negro blood. So it usually came from the other.
Well, what in a case like that, particularly if where you have an individual or maybe a community that would qualify as, you use the term, as maybe being racially ambiguous, or maybe where the issue just never really quite came up, how, for someone like that, what sort of defense could that a person like that possibly mount?
These cases are fascinating because there you really see the amount, the lack of consensus that could exist in a community, even one that seemed to have been going along, as far as we can tell, up to then without overt conflict. But the neighbors will appear to have complete disagreement over, you know, who these people are. Some appear to think, for example, you know, yeah, they probably have some African blood, but, you know, they've always acted like a white person, and we're okay with that. You know, we don't care. Others appear to believe that they were one thing or the other. Often I notice the term Portuguese is used by people who want to claim I've always had, appears to count as some kind of white identity, but different. And so Portuguese is just the name they'll take on. So they kind of, there can be a lot of disagreement. One thing I also did in one of the chapters is look at three of these communities who had some mixture, probably, of Indian, African, and European ancestry, and look at the strategies that they took as a community to deal with the pressure to fall on the black or the white side of the line. So the Melungeons were a community in Tennessee who claimed whiteness, and they tend to kind of do this as individuals. The Croatans, today known as the Lumbee, who are still involved in for federal recognition as a tribe, they're a North Carolina tribe, and they were equally challenged all the time as being mixed with black and not really being Indian, and they forcefully argued that they were Indian, not black, and one a kind of third, in a Jim Crow state, they got a third set of institutions, their own school committee, a kind of intermediate racial group. And the last one I looked at was the Narragansett, who were an Indian tribe in Rhode Island who had mixed a lot with Africans in early on and into the 19th century, and they never rejected that. They always said, yes, we're mixed, but we're Indian. And that was always a basis for constant efforts to detribalize them, which were eventually successful. And when they reorganized as a tribe in the 20th century, they finally, you know, succumbed to that, said, you know, we're not black. We reject, you know, our black members. So it was a process of really distancing oneself from blackness in order to get citizenship. Mm-hmm.
You do also, because as you said, this is, you're attempting to tell a story over a fairly broad sweep of American history. You do have a section where you talk about Hawaii. How did these issues play out there, and was it essentially the same?
So I look at Hawaii as the tail end of the land allotment era. Many people probably know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, the federal government changes gears in Indian policy and decides to break up tribal governments, break up tribal lands, give small plots of land to individual Native Americans, and then open the rest as surplus that would be available to, on the mainland, it's mainly white settlers. In Hawaii, it's big sugar and ranch companies. And it's at the moment of land allotment that blood quantum first becomes a legally meaningful category for Indians and for other Native peoples, including Hawaiians. So I first talk about that process in Indian territory, where there's this Jim Crow process of enrolling Indians separately from what were called freedmen, which really meant anyone who counted as Negro or had African ancestry. But then in Hawaii, in 1920, when they go through the same land allotment process, and there are no people of African descent, but the same idea of blood quantum is imported into the law, and Native Hawaiians are defined according to blood quantum for the first time. And it's quite explicit in the legislative discussions, you know, hey, if we define it as 1/32nd Native Hawaiian ancestry, that would be a lot of people getting land, but if we make it only 1/2, it'll be a lot fewer people getting land. And so that is, in fact, the definition that comes into the legislative act is 1/2 Native Hawaiian blood makes you. And today, again, the Supreme Court just recently decided a case a few years back saying, aha, Native Hawaiians, which you would think is the most national identity possible since it was a nation conquered by the U.S., right, 100 years ago, that's really not a national but a racial identity, racial classification. And I think that's because these notions of blood were imported into the law, and now it's come back to haunt Hawaiians.
We're coming down to the point where you maybe have about 5 or 6 minutes left. Just, again, very quick, I would like to introduce again our guest, Ariella Gross. She's professor of law and history at University of Southern California and is author of the book What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America. It's published by the Harvard University Press. I wanted to sort of step up to where we are right now, because I think that one of the key ideas here, or at least one of the things that you're suggesting, is that when we look back at this history, we look at this period where perhaps people were confused about race and what it meant, or at least that they did a lot of arguing about it, but that we might be inclined to say, well, now, though, we got that all figured out, and we know what race means, or maybe we say that it doesn't mean anything anymore, but that we don't. It's not something that we're still conflicted about or arguing about. And I think that you probably would make the argument that no, in fact, we're not really quite any more certain what we mean about this now than at any other point in American history.
I think there's a tendency when we look back at the past, or when we separate ourselves from the past, to think, okay, racism in the past was just about biology. It was a now discredited biological understanding of race and blood. And since we don't have that anymore, since we now realize that race is, you know, socially and historically constructed, it's not a biological category, that we're free of racism. And I think what I hope to do in the book is just show us that despite, you know, some enormous victories and, of course, the milestone of an African-American president, that there are some ways that we haven't escaped, that it's not so easy to escape our past, in part because racism has been mobile. It isn't based only on biology, but it's been based on a number of different things, and therefore it may be harder to eradicate, and sometimes it's based on culture rather than biology, and that can be harder to get rid of as well.
Well, can we say, though, at the very least, that we have now arrived at a place where every individual gets to decide who he or she is, and that's that. And then they proceed from there. We say to people, well, all right, you can decide and go on from there.
You know, yes and no. I mean, I think that I think, for example, it's right that the government uses self-identification as a basis for whatever classifications we still need to use for purposes of data collection and so on in official state law that we use self-determination, but I don't think it's right, in fact, that anyone gets to that who we say we are is the end of the story, and that we don't have to deal with identities that are ascribed to us by others. You know, as a simple example, Barack Obama is the son of a white woman and an African father, and he has made a choice, a political and cultural choice to identify as African American. But I don't know if he would actually be, if he could actually get away with, had he chosen to, identify himself another way. I think it would have been difficult for him and dissonant to his own experience, which in which, you know, he suffered discrimination growing up. You know, he saw incidents of racism he describes in his book. It would have been hard for him, you know, to continue saying if he had wanted to identify a different way as mixed race or white, right? Think about it. It would have been pretty hard to say, I'm white because I'm half, you know, because my mother's white and I grew up with my mother. So I don't think, in fact, that all identities are open to everyone to choose. Even today, there are many factors that go into them, one of which is a choice, but it's a very constrained choice.
Well, clearly, it's something that we're still wrestling with, and maybe that's something we should expect. We're still going to be wrestling with for, you know, who knows how long.
Yes, and you know, maybe I'm hopeful that President-elect Obama's, I love to say those words together, but that his election may make it possible for us to have a more open discussion about this, because I think one of the things that's been striking is how limited our discussion of race has been in the society. Either it's been, you know, we should be colorblind and ignore what we see, you know, ignore, not see race, and that's the solution, or we've had a kind of identity politics about, you know, holding on to every aspect of racial groups as they exist today. And what may be possible now, one hopes, is that there could be a little deeper discussion. And I thought that, for example, his speech in March about race after the Jeremiah Wright thing was unprecedented for a major candidate for president to give such a frank discussion of the history of race and racism, and yet the possibilities for us to unite for some better future. I don't think it's possible for us to do that till we reckon with the history, and that's why I do what I do.
All right. And if people would like to read more on the subject we have been talking about here, again, the book is What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America, published by the Harvard University Press, by our guest Ariana Gross. She is professor of law and history at USC, University of Southern California. Professor Gross, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The broadcast today made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 26th annual Arts and Craft Show and Sale, November 22nd and 23rd at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday from 10 to 5, Sunday from 10 to 4. More information at 367-9546. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There will be more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be a physician who is also a medical historian and bioethicist. His name is Dr. Robert Martinson, and he's the author of A Life Worth Living, A Doctor's Reflections on Illness in a High-Tech Era. We'll talk with him today following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat, 553.5, that contract down 14.5. March, 569.5, down 15. In Chicago, December wheat, 507, down 14. March, 530, down 12. December corn, 375.5, unchanged. March, 392, down 1.5. May, 405.75, up 1/4. July, 415, down 2. November soybeans, 915, up 3.25. January, 920, down 1. March, 928, down 1.5. May, 940, up 1/2. December soybean meal, 271 even, down 70. December oil, 3403, up 13. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 92.62.5, down 17.5. February, 93.45, down 10. November feeder cattle, 98.95. That is unchanged. January, 98.60, down 62.5. December lean hogs, 55.05, down 35. Outside markets, December crude in New York trading at 60.90, down 14. The U.S. dollar, 85.82. Down 30. The CRB index, 259.98. That is